The reading from 1 Peter, Peter 4, we'll pick up in verse 12 through 19. We're in that section of 1 Peter that has to do with how we live in response to God's great redemptive work on our behalf. And here we're taking up a very solemn passage having to do with the expectation that Peter has of these people to whom he is writing, that they will be facing persecution and in the very near future. So please join with me as we read, starting at 1 Peter 4, verse 12. And reading through verse 19. Beloved, do not think it strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, as though some strange thing happened to you, but rejoice to the extent that you partake of Christ's sufferings, that when his glory is revealed, you may also be glad with exceeding joy. If you are reproached for the name of Christ, blessed are you, for the Spirit of glory and of God rests upon you. On their part, he is blasphemed, but on your part, he is glorified. But let none of you suffer as a murderer, a thief, an evildoer, or a busybody in other people's matters. Yet if anyone suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed, but let him glorify God in this matter. For the time has come for judgment to begin at the house of God. And if it begins with us first, what will be the end of those who do not obey the gospel of God? Now, if the righteous one is scarcely saved, where will the ungodly and the sinner appear? Therefore, let those who suffer according to the will of God commit their souls to him in doing good as to a faithful creator. May the Lord add his blessing to the reading and understanding that comes from his word. The first non-biblical Christian martyr of which we have a historical record that I'm aware of was a man named Polycarp. He was born around 70 A.D. in Asia, we think in the city of Smyrna, where basically he lived for most of his life. And Polycarp was burned at the stake in around 156 A.D. when he was 86 years old. He was burned at the stake in front of thousands of people in a Colosseum. It's said that the flames didn't actually kill him, even though he was immersed in them, and that he was finally killed by being stabbed to death with a spear. Now, Polycarp is said to have been an apostle, a disciple of the apostle John. Now, that may have been true, since John was in that area and he lived to about 100 A.D. Polycarp may very well have also known Peter himself, as a very young man. We think Peter died much earlier than that. But when Polycarp was a young man, he may very well have heard Peter preach. He was bishop of the church at Smyrna and was probably born there, as I said. And Smyrna is effectively only about 40 miles away from Ephesus, which is in modern-day Turkey. Of course, Paul went through that area, as we all know. And that area is the area to which Peter addresses this letter. And since Peter has addressed this letter to the people of Asia, the Christians who are in Asia, then it may very well have been that Polycarp was one of the first ones to read or to hear these words, and maybe even preach them from his pulpit in Smyrna. He may have been one of those to whom these verses in today's passage were directly addressed to speak. What does the record say about Polycarp and his death? When the officers and soldiers came to arrest him and take him to the arena where he was to be killed, he didn't run. Now, he was 86 years old. He couldn't run fast even if he did. But he was 86 years old, but he made no attempt whatsoever to escape from them. When they came to get him, he invited them into his house. He said, could I have some time to pray before you take me? And they said, yes. And he said, okay, prepare a meal, bring some food for these people to eat and some wine, and let them eat and drink while I'm praying. Now, that's what he did for those who came to arrest him. He told his servants to prepare a meal. He showed them hospitality, and then he prayed. And the account is that he prayed for about 2 hours. They took him to this huge Colosseum. It was filled with both Jews and Gentiles, because by this time in 150 AD, the Jews were rabidly against Christians. And so it was both Gentiles and Jews that were in the Colosseum. And all of them were screaming for his blood. He was an important man. By that time, there were lots of Christians in Turkey, modern-day Turkey. And the local Roman governor, like Pontius Pilate before him, tried to reason with him. "Look," he said, "nobody really cares if you're a Christian or not. You'd be a Christian. Nobody doesn't care that much about that. All we want is for you to be a good citizen. And here's what you need to do. What harm is there," he says, "in saying Lord Caesar? What harm is there in sacrificing when we have public occasions so that this public institution of religious worship is not undermined and causing everybody to get upset? On your own, in your own private house, believe whatever you want. Pray to whomever you want to. But just don't avoid and stay away and tell other people that they can't participate in the religious rituals of which we bind ourselves together and confess Caesar as being our king." Polycarp said no. The guy tried again. He says, "Swear by the name of Caesar, repent, and say, 'Away with atheists.'" In other words, just say that you believe in God. Polycarp stepped away from him. He looked up at all of the thousands of people in the stands who were waiting for him to die, and he said, "Away with atheists." Not exactly what the proconsul was looking for. He then turned to him and he says, "You threaten me with fire, a fire that burns for an hour, and after that, the time is extinguished. But I tell you of another fire, that of the coming judgment. And it is an eternal punishment reserved for the ungodly. But why are you delaying? If you intend to burn me with fire, then let it begin." Can you imagine that, standing in the middle of a Colosseum, looking up at crowds of people? They're waiting to see you die. And in order to make it a spectacle, they want it to be as horribly conducted as it can be. And then standing there, looking up at those people and saying, "You are the atheist, not me. I am a Christian, and I will never call Caesar Lord, for there is one Lord of heaven and earth, and that one Lord is Jesus of Nazareth, the Christ of God, and it is he who will judge you for what you do today." Now, Polycarp's death, from the record we have, is a textbook example of the very situation that Peter is describing in these verses. And Peter says, don't think it strange concerning the fiery trial that is facing you. With Polycarp, it was literally fiery trial. And it was not unusual for Christians to have to face what he faced. And that's what Peter said was going to be the case. Peter says in verse 19 that it is the will, that if it is the will of God for some to suffer in his name, that it is the will of God for some to suffer in his name. And he says, if you're one of those, this is how you're to conduct yourself. He says the church is going to be judged. He says that judgment was beginning with the household of God. God is in the process of judging the world, Peter says. And he is clarifying the situation that exists in the world by the manner in which he is conducting events in the world. And there would no longer be any question as to who is a Christian and who is not when God gets through with this phase of judgment. There would no longer be any confusion between the Jews and the Gentiles, or the Jews and the Christians. There would no longer be any question of whether the Christians were just a subset of the Jews or not. There will not be any question in the minds of the Gentiles. There won't be any question in the minds of the Jews. And there certainly won't be any question in the minds of the Christians themselves. there would no longer be any confusion. God is clarifying the situation. There were Christians, and the Christians were going to be the ones who confessed Christ even in the face of great persecution. As Randy has mentioned, some during that period of time would become traitors. And because of the intensity of the persecution, they would actually turn in their brothers and sisters in the faith in order to save their own life. Some would give in to what the proconsul was telling them to do. Look, in the privacy of your own home, do whatever you want. But publicly, bow your knee to Caesar, because after all, what harm could it do? I mean, we all really know he's not a god. Just go ahead. Go through the ritual. What harm could it be? Some would give that. Judgment of the whole world, judgment of the Roman Empire, was underway. And at the very center of the trial was the Christian church and the Christians who were in it. As the nation of Israel, as the people of Israel were judged by the way they treated Jesus of Nazareth, so now the Roman Empire was being judged by the way they treated the body of Christ, which was his church. And as Christ was crucified, so the church was to suffer. And in a sense, rise from the grave. As Peter himself and Paul and the other apostles said very clearly, the persecution of the church, as we shall talk about shortly, is to be understood as the sufferings of Christ in the present age. It was he that they were persecuting. It was he who stood in that Colosseum. It was he, Jesus, through his church, who proclaimed the verdict of judgment and gave the offer of salvation. It was Jesus that they hated. And it was for Jesus. And to show forth Jesus, that Christians were asked to suffer and to die. That is what Peter is saying in these verses. And that's how we are to see and understand it. And if you are called upon to face it someday, and some of you will, then remember, Peter is saying, this is what it's all about. Don't think it strange that you are to partake of Christ's sufferings. Accept it. Count it as an honor to die for him, no matter what you face. And like Polycarp, think of it as a high privilege. Why? Because he is worth it. And that's the main point, the central teaching of this text. Peter says it very clearly. Look at it with me, and we'll see how he does. In verses 12 and 13, Peter says that we are to recognize it is not an unusual thing, it is not strange for the church to be persecuted. And that we are to understand it in terms of a continued or an ongoing suffering of Christ. Now, that's kind of strange to us. We are to think of the ongoing persecution of the church as a continued suffering of Christ himself. That's exactly what he says. Beloved, do not think it strange concerning the fiery trial which is to try you, but rejoice to the extent that you partake of Christ's suffering. Then he goes on to say that when his glory is revealed, you will be glad with exceeding joy. Obviously an allusion to the resurrection. Now what we must understand from this is something that we practical, pragmatic, everyday engineering type Americans have a little trouble getting through our thick skulls. There is a sense in which the life of Jesus himself is reenacted or reincarnated, if you will, in every age in the church. In every age and in the culture by the church. In the gospel, through the church, Jesus comes to every tribe and every culture in the progress of time. He comes in the Spirit as the gospel spreads throughout the whole world, and it has to spread. He himself said it had to spread. The gospel is to be preached in all of the world, Jesus said, and then the end will come. But as Peter and Paul and all the rest of the apostles saw it. It's not just an academic thing. Jesus is really present in his church doing this, taking the gospel to the world. And when Jesus brings the gospel to a land, to a nation, to a people group, we have to see it in terms of he himself coming. In a sense, he is born into that culture. He grows up in that culture as the church progresses. He does great things in the culture, miraculous things, through his people, the church. And in that culture, as that witness grows stronger and stronger, opposition arises. And sooner or later, the culture turns on him. The powers of darkness who put him on the cross turn on the church. They turn on the word that is being preached. And they bring hatred of Jesus to a burning pitch. And they begin to persecute him and revile him. And they even torture him and put him to death. You see, that's the understanding that Peter is trying to communicate to that first church, or those early Christians in that church. That's the underlying principle of what he's trying to get across. And the church of Christ, then, is called to partake of Christ's sufferings in the world in an ongoing manner. Now, what does that show? It's the way that he judges the world in every age. That's the way he judges his church as the world, as the church progresses through each age. It's in the way he proves before the eyes of the world who are his elect servants, and who are not. The nation of Israel, the people of the Jews, they stand condemned today because of their rejection and their continued rejection of the Christ who came to them as their Messiah. They heard him, they saw him, and they rejected him. The Roman Empire in its day, and every other nation that has ever heard the gospel and has turned and rejected it since, has done the exact same thing. As the Apostle John saw, Jesus, the Son of God, is mounted on a white horse, and he's going throughout the world with the sharp sword of his gospel coming out of his mouth. He is stretching forth that offer of salvation and that total commitment and prophecy of judgment. That is his proclamation. That is his gospel. And all of those who see him and hear him as he marches through time and as he marches through this earth, all who see him and believe him, follow him gladly in the victorious march that he is accomplishing. But all of those who hear and reject him as Lord, they are slain by that very word that is coming out of his mouth. They are judged and condemned to death by the word that he, Jesus himself, is speaking. That is what John prophesied. That is what he saw in his revelation. And that's what we are to understand about the progress of time. Brothers and sisters, that's history. That's what's happening. That's history yesterday, that's history today, and for as long as the Lord tarries, that's history tomorrow. There's nothing new under the sun. As it was, so it is, and so it will be. Our Lord and God stands above it and says, I am the Alpha and the Omega. I am the beginning and the end. This is history. This is how we're to understand our life, and this is how we're to understand where our life is headed. So how are we supposed to respond to this? Peter tells us in the next few verses. As Polycarp clearly understand, so we are to understand. As Polycarp clearly understood, so we are to understand that it is all about Christ. It is about Christ being present in his church. And that therefore we are supposed to live and to die, if so called, in such a way as to make it very clear that it's not about us, it's about him. Peter says in verses 14 and 15, that if we are persecuted for the name of Christ, we are blessed. That's a little hard to get a hold of. If we're having to face a hungry lion, you know the reason why they didn't feed Polycarp to the lion, to the lions? They had already fed them. The animals were not hungry anymore. Is that scary or what? So they burned him and then stabbed him. But he says that if we are persecuted for the name of Christ, we are blessed. And we have to see it that way. Because he says that on their part, Jesus is being blasphemed because we are having to suffer for his name. But on your part, Peter says, he is glorified. For only Christ can explain why anyone would stand up to that kind of treatment when there's a way out readily available. Therefore, we must not do the kind of things that make it about us, Peter says. We are to avoid the kind of life that corresponds to evil, being a murderer or an evildoer or being a gossip. Evildoer, murderer, gossip. All about the same. Why? As a busybody, Peter calls it. Because those are the kind of people that deserve to die. They deserve to die because they have committed deeds that are worthy of death. Peter says, that makes it about you. You do that stuff, it's no longer about Christ. So therefore, we are to avoid evil. We are to be known for our good works and our good conduct, so that we are not ashamed as Christians, but rather, if we are called upon to suffer, then God will be glorified in our suffering. Now, this is what Peter plainly says. The main point is this. That's because it's all about Christ. And that's how we're to understand it. It's not about us. It's about Him. And whatever we're called upon to face, we must be continually pointing the eyes of the world to that truth. That we are to see our lives as a witness to Him. We are to be holy and harmless and undefiled in this life to the greatest extent that we can, because that is our witness. That is our defense. We have done nothing worthy of death. We have done nothing worthy of condemnation. All that can be truly said of us is that we went around doing good and helping others. Now, brothers and sisters, doesn't that remind you of somebody? Does that not remind you of Christ? The people of God are supposed to be like Christ because He is inhabiting His church as He does the very things in us and through us as He did when He walked this earth, and then what will happen as a result of that in time. There will be a time when He is rejected by those to whom we are witnessing. And when that happens, we must strive that our witness will be that it's about Him. Because that's the way Christ judges the world, and that's the way Christ judges His church. It begins with the church. The church is judged by that very same criterion. Christians in the church are judged by this rule. Are we, you and I, individually, sold out for Christ? Are we willing to take His yoke upon us and follow Him, even if it is unto suffering and even death? Are we willing to devote our lives to showing forth His body before the eyes of the world, knowing that the world will turn on us sooner or later and that the world will show its true colors because of us? And that inevitably, unless the Lord returns, that the world will be condemned around us by the evidence of how they treat us, the church. That their despising of us is because they despise Him. And that is the judgment that Christ will render upon them. But it is also how Christ will render judgment upon the members of his church who do not take up that calling, who call themselves Christians, but cannot embrace the total commitment that he calls forth. And so that brings us to our motivation. It's a reasonable question. In fact, it's a question every Christian should ask, because Jesus himself tells us that we should ask it, is why in the world would we do this? If this is the way we're to view our lives, as being sold out to Christ, such that if he calls upon us to suffer, even to the point of giving up our life in a horrible fashion rather than deny him, if this is the way that Christ is controlling history, so that once you become a Christian, it's not hunky-dory for the rest of history, and that the church, once it's established, just prospers and continues to prosper, and it never has any problems, and there's never any persecution or suffering of the church, if that's not how he is conducting history, but rather that we have to be ready at any time when the world turns on us, and that we have to stand up and suffer for his name, why in the world would anybody want to be a Christian? The answer is very simple. Peter has told us the answer to that question in every page of this letter. We should not only embrace the idea of being a Christian, we should commit our lives and our soul to him in doing so, whatever road he puts before us to walk, because we should walk it as a Christian, because he is worth it, no matter what. That's the touchstone of our calling, brothers and sisters. That is the standard by which we are judged. That is the standard that separates the sheep from the goats. That is the way the angels one day will separate the wheat from the tares, when God himself sends them from heaven to reap the harvest in his fields. The standard is simply this: no matter what it is that I or you or the whole church is facing and will have to face, the standard that we face it with is simply this: Christ is worth it. He is the most precious thing in the world. He is more precious than the riches that the rich young ruler possessed, and which made him turn away from Christ when Christ presented him with that very same standard. He is more precious than even our own close relatives that a man wanted to bury rather than follow Jesus right away. He is more precious than even our own life, as Paul has said, counting all things as dung compared to the high honor of knowing Christ, the supreme joy of knowing him. Jesus is worth it, brothers and sisters. That is our faith. And in a sense, it is the entirety of our faith. Jesus is worth it. He is alive. He is not dead. And he is all that is beautiful and perfect in this world. He is ruling this world and causing all things to work together for good for those who love him and have been called according to his purpose. We may not see that. We may see only the suffering that is in front of us. But behind that suffering, brothers and sisters, is something beautiful. He is bringing good out of it. That's how good and powerful he really is. He's busy about the business of taking people's lives and transforming them. We've heard that from this very pulpit, as people among us have testified to that end. He is busy reaching down into time and space and rescuing people from the hopelessness that is their misery. He is causing them to be born again from the dead, lifting them up out of the swamp of sin and setting their feet on solid ground, giving them meaning and purpose for their lives. That is an amazing thing. He hates sin, absolutely, but he is the God of love and compassion. And for all who believe in him, they have found forgiveness of their sins and rest for their souls, rest even under the tree. That's just how good He is. We sing, He is more precious than silver, more valuable than gold. And what we really mean is this. He is worth whatever it takes to serve Him. It is only through Him that we can be happy in the sense of being content. He is the one who promises us the desires of our heart if we wait on Him. That's how good He is. So the question that is for us today, is facing us today, is the same question that faces the entire Church of Jesus Christ in this land in which we live. And opposition to Christ in this land, as opposition to Christ in this land gets stronger and stronger and more intense. As all around us we see churches and in fact entire denominations giving in to the pressure and making compromises with regard to their faith so that the scorn and ridicule that is being heaped upon them will be alleviated. As we see judgment coming first on the house of God all around us, the question for us is simply this. Is He worth it to us? How we answer as churches or as individuals determines where we stand with Him. We can either stand with Polycarp and those like him throughout the years, or we can stand with the people who are in the stands laughing and making rude noises at Polycarp. We stand either with Polycarp or we stand with those who deny Christ and persecute His church. There is no middle ground. We're either in one place or the other. The question that distinguishes us and tells us where we stand is simply this. Is He worth it? No matter what it takes. Let's pray.